It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about legislation co-sponsored by a Wisconsin congressional representative aimed at preventing dead zones in Wisconsin waterways.
First, 50 years ago today, in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law, which prohibited any form of racial discrimination when it comes to voting. Some have called it the most successful civil rights statute in the nation's history and the crown jewel of the civil rights movement.
50 years later, the law stands on unsteady ground, especially after a 2013 Supreme Court ruling that invalidated a key part of that law. And there have been court battles over voter ID laws around the country, with a federal appeals court ruling this week against a Texas voter ID law.
Here with us to talk about that case and the Voting Rights Act 50 years later is Josh Douglas. He's an associate professor of law at the University of Kentucky. Josh, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So 50 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, where does the act stand today?
Well, the act is really, as you said in the introduction, a beacon of the civil rights movement. And yet court decisions have really questioned how successful the act can be moving forward in really protecting and expanding the right to vote. We've had some key court decisions that really weaken the act. And so voting rights advocates moving forward are looking for ways to both strengthen the act for the courts and seek legislative fixes for what the Supreme Court did in its 2013 decision.
So we're going to go back to 1965 now in the civil rights era for a moment. How did this legislation come to be in the first place?
Well, it was really a part of the broader struggle for civil rights during that time period. And in particular, there was a concern about some states, particularly in the South, that were staying one step ahead of the courts in denying the right to vote to racial minorities. What you would have is a state in the South craft some sort of a test or device to prevent registration or voting.
And what kind of thing would that? Minorities. What kind of thing would that be?
Well, things like literacy tests and really complicated literacy tests that, you know, I couldn't pass if I tried to take it and actually pass. There's so much discretion. Questions like, can you tell me how many bubbles there are in a bar of soap? Were kind of the common things that Southern registrars would impose on particularly African-American voters to prevent them from registering and prevent them from voting. And so Congress and really President Johnson, through a coalition of civil rights leaders, saw the need for a federal fix to this. And one of the key provisions of the Voting Rights Act is known as Section 5. And what Section 5 does is it says states in certain areas that have a history of racial discrimination, before you can enact a new law and put it into practice, you have to get federal approval for it. It's known as preclearance. Basically what that means is you have to go to the Department of Justice in D.C. or a federal court to demonstrate that the law doesn't have a discriminatory purpose, wasn't passed for the reason of discrimination, and it's not going to have discriminatory effect on minority voters. And that was the key provision at issue in the 2013 case.
Right, and that was actually struck down in 2013. What happened?
Well, so when Congress passed this law in 1965, there's several different provisions, but this one, Section 5, it said, you know, we don't think we need Section 5, this federal oversight on southern states forever. We think there can be a sunset period, a date by which the act will expire, this portion of the act will expire. And Congress set it at 5 years initially, and then when it was about to expire, Congress renewed it for another 7. It was about to expire, renewed it again, and Congress has continually renewed it. In 1982, Congress renewed it for 25 years, and each time it was renewed, it was challenged all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court had upheld it. And then in 2006, the act was set to expire once again, and Congress reauthorized it for another 25 years, saying that we're still not where we need to be in terms of equality in voting, and that certain southern states still need that federal oversight. So it was really that reauthorization, that extending of the act for an additional 25 years in 2006 that was before the court. And the court in 2013, this case known as Shelby County, said that Congress stepped over its bounds, that the Congress did not have the evidence it needed to reauthorize the act for another 25 years. The court, in a 5-4 decision, with Chief Justice Roberts writing the opinion, said times have changed since the act was initially passed, and it the court did not feel that Congress had the same kind of evidence that it had 50 years ago about the inequalities in voting.
We're talking to Josh Douglas right now, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, and we were just talking about Act 5, which called for this preclearance of any law that could perhaps pose discriminatory rules on certain groups of people. So now that that preclearance act is no longer active, what is it? How does the law usually get used? How does it function today?
Well, now the key part of the act is in Section 2. And Section 2 prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, but the key difference here is that instead of having oversight for an act get implemented, a plaintiff has to sue, and the state can use the electoral practice that's being challenged during the pendency of the litigation. Now, litigation can take years as it wades its way through the court system. So the really important part about Section 5 is it stopped the state from implementing a law for an upcoming election until the federal government or a federal court said it wouldn't be discriminatory. Now a state like Texas with its voter ID law can implement the law for the next election, and it'll get sued under Section 2 for saying that the law has a discriminatory purpose or a discriminatory effect. But Texas can continue using that law during the litigation, and that's exactly what's happened. So the timing is really one key component here of what was different between the old regime before the Supreme Court's decision in that 2013 case and today's world.
Okay, so fast-forwarding to this case in Texas that would just happen this week, a federal appeals panel ruled that a strict voter ID law in the state there was in violation of the Voting Rights Act. Now this case has been watched by legal observers to see if the Voting Rights Act can stand without that key provision that the Supreme Court struck down. So what do you make of this ruling?
Well, I think it was an important ruling because it affirmed the lower court's finding that the law as implemented by Texas would have a discriminatory effect. What that basically means is that the court found that more minority voters would lack an ID or the documentation required to get an ID than the majority white voters. And Section 2 prohibits voting rules that have a discriminatory effect, an effect that makes minority voters worse off. So I think it's a really important decision in demonstrating that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act still has some teeth. Now, what remains to be seen is what happens if and when this case gets to the U.S. Supreme Court, because just like the court gutted the Section 5 preclearance provision, I think there's some concern that the court might cut at the knees of Section 2 as well.
So where do you see this moving forward as we have this Texas ruling in? You talked about Act 2. What is the next sticking point as we go forward?
I think the big sticking point is, did Congress have the authority to regulate elections under Section 2 for claims of vote denial? Like, a challenge to a voter ID law says, you're denying my right to vote because I can't produce the ID. Traditionally, this Section 2 that prohibits discriminatory effects applies to redistricting, or has applied to redistricting, the drawing of legislative lines. And so it's a little bit, I wouldn't say novel, but it's a different theory when we're using Section 2 on these vote denial cases as opposed to talking about the way we draw district lines. And again, I think one concern of voting rights advocates is that the Supreme Court might say, no, Section 2 only applies to redistricting and does not apply to these kinds of vote denial cases. And that can be a real problem for people trying to challenge voter ID laws. Which another important thing about this, this federal appeals court in Texas that issued this decision yesterday, is that it actually ruled for the state on some of the other claims. It ruled that the plaintiffs didn't show enough evidence of discriminatory purpose, that is, that the law was purposely trying to discriminate against minorities. It ruled that the voter ID law was not an impermissible poll tax. And so this Section 2 was the only thing that the plaintiffs won on. And so if the court strikes at this kind of use of Section 2, then it could be further difficult for plaintiffs to win these kinds of claims.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to do so. Thanks so much.
That was Josh Douglas, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky. He joined us to talk about the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act.
There's been a growing problem in recent years with so-called dead zones in areas around the Great Lakes, including the waters of Green Bay. The dead zones are triggered by algae blooms caused by the runoff of phosphorus and other nutrients.
Farms and livestock operations are a major source of these nutrients, which end up in the Fox River and other waterways, and ultimately in Green Bay itself. A Wisconsin congressional representative is joining other Midwestern lawmakers in legislation aimed at controlling farm runoff.
Reed Ribble represents Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, which includes Green Bay, Appleton, and the surrounding area. He held a Save the Bay summit earlier this year. Representative Ribble, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be with you. Thank you.
Well, let's start with the scope of the problem you're tackling here. What are we worried about in the waters of Green Bay?
Well, you know, over the last several years, there's been a growing dead zone inside the Bay of Green Bay. And this actually extends through the Fox River and down into Lake Winnebago. So it covers the Lake Winnebago and Fox River watershed as well as Green Bay. And we're getting enough algae growing in the bay that it literally kills virtually everything growing there. And when you've got such a strong tourist industry like we do in Door County, it's really important that we deal with this.
And is there general agreement that a lot of the pollutants, the things causing these algae blooms, are coming from agricultural sources?
Well, about 50%, here's where the agreement is, about 50% comes from agriculture, 50% comes from what we call point source, or coming from urban areas. And so those urban areas typically are the water's treated to a wastewater treatment facility and then put back into the river and ultimately into the bay. And non-point sources are coming from agriculture around the area. And Wisconsin, as you're aware, has a very large agricultural footprint. We grow a lot of things here, and we produce a lot of dairy and milk here. And so about half of the problem is coming from agriculture.
Well, what are you proposing in this new legislation, the Great Lakes Assurance Program Verification Act?
Yeah, well, basically what this bill does is it takes existing funds out of the USDA's Environmental Quality Incentives Program. It's called EQIP. It takes about $30 million of money from there and redirects it in the form of grants to state agencies to provide both technical and financial assistance to work on this issue. Because really, a lot of this, we know what has to happen, and it requires some education training for farmers on best practices. And what this will help us do is get to that place.
What kind of education and training could a farmer who participates get out of this program?
Well, in this case, they might get training on better ways of managing how they spread manure, what times of year they spread manure, where they spread manure, how they till fields, how much loose soil are they working up in the top of the soil that might become loose and have embedded phosphorus or attached phosphorus to it. There's a lot of practices with creating buffer zones along ditches and drainage areas and things like that that we can begin to facilitate and help farmers with, so that hopefully voluntarily we begin to get more and more farmers aware of the problem and then dealing with it on their farm, no matter what the size.
I understand this is based in part on an example from our neighbors in Michigan. Is that right?
That's correct. In fact, the main author of the bill is Candace Miller from Michigan. She's one of my colleagues in Congress, and they have a similar program that they've been working in Michigan called the Michigan Agricultural Environmental Assurance Program. And it's been relatively successful over in Michigan along Michigan's waterways. And so she's applied what they've learned over there into this piece of legislation, and it looks like it'd be helpful for us here in Wisconsin.
You mentioned this is voluntary for farmers. Are you hopeful that enough farmers would participate to actually make a difference, put a dent in this problem?
Well, I think that this problem is so large, it's going to take more than just this program. This program is just one piece of a fairly large puzzle. I've been having ongoing meetings literally all summer with both conservationists and the dairy industry, with crop farmers, with the wastewater treatment people, conservationists and whatnot, trying to get my own mind around what the issue is. And then we're going to continue to do this during the month of August while I'm on recess to hopefully begin to create a model document or best practices that we can start to promote and help farmers begin to recognize what role they could play in improving our water quality.
We're talking to Wisconsin Congressional Representative Reed Ribble about his legislation and efforts to clean up pollution that's causing problems in the in Green Bay and the related watersheds. And you mentioned, Congressman Ribble, these summits you've been having with people involved, farmers, conservationists, and others. What other kind of solutions are people suggesting apart from what you're doing in this legislation?
Yeah, depending on the size of farm, the solutions are kind of all over the map. So if you're a smaller farmer and you have the ability to do managed grazing, having your animals out rather than collecting manure and spreading it, just having it natural. So for some of those smaller farms, you do with managed grazing practices. The types of grasses that they're growing in buffer zones can have a different effect, because the root structure on some types of grasses can grow very, very deep, up to 15, 16 feet deep where the soil will allow it, versus grasses that might only have a root structure that goes 4 or 5 inches deep. And we're getting all of these types of things, how to pull water out of manure, where should you be using digesting, and how can that help to take manure and actually separate its components. And so there's been a lot of information that has come in not only to my office, but to the conservationists as well as experts at University of Wisconsin in Madison and in Green Bay. It's been really helpful.
Do you see other legislation down the road in addition to what you're talking about now?
It's possible, as long as I know that it'll work. And one of the things that I've been cautious about is just, A, willy-nilly throwing money at a problem, but B, also willy-nilly throwing a regulation at a problem. Because a one-size-fits-all regulatory environment won't necessarily solve the problem. And let me give an example. The problem that they're having in Kewaunee County up here is in part due to the fact that there's a small amount of surface soil or topsoil over a rock bed. That's not the case in, let's say, Waupaca or Shawnee County, where the soil type is different. There's no rock underneath the soil. The slope and terrain of the counties are different, and that goes to how fast water runs off the surface. And so trying to come up with a single one-size-fits-all regulatory regime may not be the best solution. I think ultimately the best solution is going to be education and awareness, and then helping our county executives have adequate conservationists in to facilitate that education process.
On a related note, there's been controversy over larger livestock operations, sometimes called CAFOs, and they're linked to pollution, especially in Kewaunee County. And there have been critics there and elsewhere saying, hey, we need limits, we need regulations on the number and concentration of livestock on these kind of operations. Could that be part of the solution in a particular place like Kewaunee County in general?
Yeah, I think if you look at a particular area of the state, and you can do some metrics on how many animals based on the soil type, slope, and density of population around there, the county may ultimately decide that they're going to put a regulatory environment in the county. And it's best done at that county level, because, like I said, Kewaunee County is so different than a county right next to it, like Brown or Calumet or even Manitowoc. They're very, very different in soil type and slope. And so having it done more locally, I think, is going to be ultimately the most effective way. However, I wouldn't necessarily just automatically say the CAFO system is not the right system, because they're highly regulated. Those farms are the most regulated farms in the country, and they have very extensive rules and requirements surrounded and around manure management and soil management. And so what we need to do is make sure that each of those farms are following those rules and actually executing the program.
I think I saw a quote from someone at one of the summits you held that, in effect, this is a problem that's been decades in the making. Do you feel confident with this and other efforts that it could be turned around?
Well, I am confident that it can be turned around, in part because it has been decades in the making. There's a lot of information about it. And the interesting thing is, I've lived in northeast Wisconsin my entire life, and I'm 59 years old, and I remember the algae blooms in Lake Winnebago when I was a child. And so this is 4 or 5 decades old, but our processes have changed over the course of time. And so there are things that we've learned over this time, and I just think overall there's a broader awareness of our environment and the importance of protecting our environment. And I believe that Wisconsin's farmers across the board want to be part of the solution. They don't want to be part of the problem, and they're actually anxious to find out more, learn more, and execute better.
Finally, do you have a timeline on this legislation that would help train farmers and help them do some of these conservation practices?
Yeah, I would like to see this pass into law before the end of the year. And the reason I say that is not just because it's an important piece of legislation for the Great Lakes, but because we're entering into this what I call the political silly season of presidential politics. And so just from my own personal experience in the Congress, things really start to slow down during presidential election years. And so I really want to try to get this done in this calendar year yet.
Congressman Ribble, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
That was Wisconsin Representative Reed Ribble talking about his legislation aimed at preventing dead zones in the waters of Green Bay and other parts of the Great Lakes. Tonight is a big night for fans of The Daily Show. We knew this day was coming, but tonight is the night Jon Stewart says goodbye. He's stepping down as host of The Daily Show after 16 years. The show began on Comedy Central and, under Stewart's leadership, transformed itself from a quirky fake news show to become part of the political landscape it made fun of. Some fans said The Daily Show dished out more truth and insight than real news delivered by professional journalists.
Robert Thompson joins us now to talk about Stewart's 16 years on The Daily Show. Thompson is a professor of television and popular culture at Syracuse University. Robert, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what makes Jon Stewart stand out if you look back on his 16 years on The Daily Show?
Well, when he first took over in late 1999, it had been hosted by Craig Kilborn, he didn't change all that much, and it wasn't all that spectacular. I think it was at the 2000 election. If you recall, that was the election that had to go to the Supreme Court and the hanging chads and all of that. And at that point, it became clear that this show had transformed into something that was serious political satire on its way to becoming investigative comedy. And, you know, we didn't have much of that on television. I grew up with Johnny Carson. He told jokes about politics, but he certainly wasn't a political satirist. Saturday Night Live, Chevy Chase used to fall down like Gerald Ford, but he gave you no insights on the Ford administration. Jon Stewart, over the past at least 15 of the 16 years, really ushered us into a period where comedy really became kind of the fifth estate, a way to contribute in important ways to the civic conversation. And even though Jon Stewart leaves tonight, he's left a lot of people who have imitated him. Larry Wilmore and John Oliver, in many ways, are out Jon Stewarting Jon Stewart.
You mentioned those 2000 elections. Let's give a listen to some of the show's coverage of that election standoff.
The state of Florida and its 25 electoral votes, with 100% of its precincts reporting, will go to George W. Bush. And the crowd loves it. The final margin in the state of Florida, 5 votes to 4 votes. Now, what's interesting about that is it's an 11% victory margin for George W. Bush, a lot greater than most pundits anticipated in what was considered a very tight race. Now, we're still here crunching some numbers. We'll be here all night. But it looks like one of the most surprising things about this Florida vote is that George W. Bush got 100% of the African American vote.
And the visuals there of the U.S. Supreme Court, not the average Florida voter, in that 5-4 margin. So talk about that. That really put them on the map. You said, Robert Thompson, they ran with that.
Yeah, they did. And they covered that story for a long time. And then there would be other in the lead up to the Gulf War. This was, of course, after September 11th. Even journalists were afraid to be appearing non-patriotic. They'd seen what had happened to the Dixie Chicks and Bill Maher and all the rest of it. And The Daily Show really plowed into that story. In many ways, they prosecuted it more intensely than a lot of quote-unquote legitimate journalists. And I think that's about that time when I really became convinced that John Stewart was doing something really important. People used to complain, oh, reports show that lots of kids are getting their ideas of politics from The Daily Show. Now they cite those same statistics, but they don't do it in a bemoaning fashion. They do it in a celebratory fashion.
Yeah, it's interesting about the substance of the show, because if you're doing these fake news shows, it seems like the obvious thing that stand-up comedians have done for decades is to go for the crazy stories, the escaped gorillas, the stupid burglars who mess it up. But The Daily Show went for substance. They pursued stories. How unusual was that?
Well, it was unusual. Again, the state of political comedy in this country existed before The Daily Show, certainly. But I think The Daily Show upped the value of it and the way it was done in significant kinds of ways. I think one of the things, the reason how they did what you're talking about is that, first of all, that show is a parody of American politics, so they talk about political leaders and all that kind of thing. But first and foremost, it became a burlesque on television news, the coverage of that politics. And once it did that, it really needed, therefore, to be looking at the more, you know, the headlines, the serious stories, the things people were talking about all day long on 24-hour cable news. And I have to think, they did that. They so raised our consciousness about some of the nonsense that goes on in television news that I've got to think every single on-camera person who worked at Fox or MSNBC or CNN or ABC or CBS had to almost constantly feel the hot breath of Jon Stewart right behind them on their neck, because if they fell into the usual cliches or did some of the usual nonsense, the sense was they might appear the next day on The Daily Show.
The show became part of the media landscape itself, though, in part, I think, because of social media and people sharing it. And then what happened on The Daily Show was a driver in the media the next day, possibly. How important did it become as a source in its own right?
Right. Well, it very much did. And that's the same as the Sunday public affairs programs. In both cases, The Daily Show and The Sunday shows, their importance in the landscape is way disproportionate to the actual size of the audience. I think if you look on average at The Daily Show's ratings on a night when people actually watching it at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock Central, I think it's considerably under 2 million. This in a country with a population of over 300 million. But you're right, stuff happens on that show, and then it gets sliced and diced, and people see little pieces of it that night or the next morning, and they pass it around. And political leaders, just like they do with Sunday programs, and editors of television news operations, often used what happened on that show in some ways to set at least part of the agenda of what they'd talk about the following day.
We're talking about Jon Stewart's last night in the host chair at The Daily Show with Robert Thompson of Syracuse University. And Robert, it was interesting the influence that Jon Stewart may have had. Now, some people dispute that, say maybe the audience numbers aren't as big as the buzz about Stewart is, but he did have some real-world ramifications. There's one pretty famous one where he may, thanks to his comments, have brought down the show Crossfire on CNN. He was a guest on that show with Tucker Carlson and Paul Begala. Here's a clip.
I made a special effort to come on the show today because I have privately, amongst my friends, and also in occasional newspapers and television shows, mentioned this show as being bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to, I felt that wasn't fair, and I should come here and tell you that I don't, it's not so much that it's bad as it's hurting America. So I wanted to
but
come here today and say...
Wait.
Here's just what I wanted to tell you guys.
Yeah.
Stop. Stop hurting America.
Okay, now...
It's funny, but the show got yanked after that. So what about the influence of Jon Stewart?
Well, that was a big one. And that was also one of the when we were just starting to talk about viral videos, videos going viral, that one had really done it. That was an early big viral video on the Internet. And it's true that Crossfire did disappear not that long after. It's hard to tell how much of that. I don't think Jon Stewart killed Crossfire any more than he's been able to take even a tiny bite out of Fox News, which he's been going after for well over a decade now. But Crossfire certainly took a reputational hit. A lot of people didn't even know Crossfire was on and saw that comment. I also think in some stories, the first responders bill was something that Stewart came out very strongly with, and I think that that put that issue, which hadn't been covered a lot in a lot of places, it hadn't already been done. But I called, I compared him back. It was 2010 to the times when people like Murrow and Cronkite would do big editorials. Back in 2010, a lot of people made fun. How could you mention Jon Stewart in the same sentence with Murrow and Cronkite? If you look online today, everybody seems to be comparing him to Cronkite.
We're talking to Robert Thompson right now about Jon Stewart's last night as host of The Daily Show. Robert Thompson is professor of television and popular culture at Syracuse University.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. At some point in the last 16 years, did you get your news from The Daily Show? Do you have any favorite moments that stick with you, still make you laugh? Do you think Jon Stewart changed the way news is delivered? Or does the news of the end of his run of The Daily Show have nothing to do with you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Robert Thompson about Jon Stewart's last night as host of The Daily Show. Robert Thompson is professor of television and pop culture at Syracuse University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you get your news from The Daily Show? Any favorite moments stand out in your mind? How do you think that kind of investigative comedy, Robert called it, has changed the way we think about news, talk about news, joke about the news? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Ashley on the line in Coloma. Ashley, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to give my two cents about my favorite moment from Jon Stewart, and it's his comparison of alcohol to marijuana and how they're treated.
Ashley, thanks a lot for the call. So does, again, you mentioned, Robert, maybe Jon Stewart only had 1 million, 2 million viewers at any given time. Weighing in on an issue like that, drawing attention to it, do you think it actually changed anyone's minds, or did it just make people already agreed with what he had to say laugh about it?
Yeah, well, what you said at first is the important part, which is it's not so much changing people's minds, but it's more putting the story out there, because oftentimes, if Jon Stewart started talking about something, it would then force other people to talk about it as well, if for no other reason than to respond. For the most part, I think Jon Stewart's fans were basically people that agreed with most of what he said and were laughing in sympathetic alignment with him. He did an interesting thing last night, on his second to last night, which I think was fascinatingly humble. He starts out saying how proud he is that he's taken on all of these things. He's taken on ISIS, he's taken on big banking, racism, Fox News. And then he goes back and updates where we are with regards to big banking today, where Fox News is today, where racism is today, and comes to the conclusion that in all those categories, big banking, things are worse than they were when Jon Stewart started. And then, of course, he goes into this big thing that maybe it was all his fault. I think the point that he was making there is an interesting one, that That show has been important. It has been an important part of our civic conversation. I think it has introduced a lot of issues and ideas to people who otherwise would not have thought about them. If we're going to say, however, Jon Stewart was able to change the world, we've got to be a little careful about that hyperbole. Fox News was one of his biggest targets, and Fox News is doing as well now as it was before he started.
But Robert, what about that news that came out, I think about a week ago, that Stewart had been invited to the White House, the Obama White House, on a couple of occasions because the White House took him seriously enough. They thought he was influential, and they invited him to talk about stuff. Does that mean he did really make a difference and have big influence?
Well, I think he did. I mean, I think changing everything, turning something around like big banking or global warming or whatever is one thing. Having an influence is another, and I think he did. If nothing else, he got an awful lot of people to think about things that they hadn't thought about before, and he came up with a way of covering stories in a comic idiom that journalists should have been covering in a repertorial journalistic idiom. A lot of people also said those meetings with Obama meant that he was in Obama's pocket. If you go back and look at the record, and he's pointed this out in the last couple of days, he was really, really hard on Obama for a good portion of the Obama administration. So I think the idea that somehow he was Obama's puppet, the evidence does not point to that at all.
And the president was a guest on his program, and
he did
razz the president a little bit, so we've got a clip of that.
You ran on very high rhetoric, hope and change, and the Democrats this year seem to be running on, please, baby, one more chance. Now, how did we go in 2 years from hope and change, we are the people we've been looking for, to you're not going to give them the keys, are you? You know, are you disappointed in how it's gone? Are you surprised that other people, even your base, can be disappointed, or do you reject that narrative?
Sense there of Jon Stewart talking to the president, who he visited at the White House. What do you make of his interactions with big political figures like the president?
Well, he's surprisingly comfortable, and he's surprisingly candid. I mean, there are a lot of people who could not have gotten away with, well, they could have done it, but asking that question in those circumstances without it appearing to be really impertinent. But I don't know. Jon Stewart has got that kind of guy down the street method. He's been so self-deprecating for most of his career that sometimes I think he gets things out of his the people he interviews that a lot of people probably couldn't. I, by the way, do not think Jon Stewart is the greatest interviewer in the world. I don't think he's even the best interview in late night. But nevertheless, the whole way that show works and his whole reputation, sometimes those great things came out of those interviews simply because of his personality and because of the people he chose to interview. A lot of people appeared on that show that were not appearing on other late night shows.
Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Ginny on the line in Plover. Ginny, hi.
Hi. Rally to Restore Sanity.
Yeah, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert did that. Did you go to that, Ginny?
Yes, we were there. Wall-to-wall people, the entire Washington Mall. I could not see the end of it. It broke the Washington subway system.
An enjoyable experience? Were you glad you went?
Oh, absolutely. It was amazing, and the people there were from every edge of the political spectrum. There were Fox News fans there. There were Comedy Central fans there. There were CNBC, MSNBC fans there. There were people who got their news from all over the place, and they were demanding that things become more civil and that people be nicer to each other.
Ginny, thanks for the call. Robert, an instance where Jon Stewart and his colleague Stephen Colbert stepped out of the screen and did a real-life event.
Yeah, I have to say, and I understand with the caller, I mean, that was a big sort of social event and everything. I actually thought that wasn't one of Stewart's or Colbert's finest moments. I think both of those two were brilliant in the shows that they did, and they did them better than anybody else. That rally had the sense, I mean, you knew when the March on Washington was over in 1963, you knew what to go out and do. There was a call, there was a charge. At the end of the rally for Sanity, there was a sense that everybody was kind of applauding and loving the messages that these guys that they were fans of were saying. But at the end of it, I always got a sense that it never really had a focused kind of call, short of what your caller very eloquently said, short of simply playing nice, which maybe that was the only message. But I thought, as someone who wasn't there, but as someone who was watching it on television, that they were not at their strongest outside of their usual venues.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Ginny. And another call here from Diana in Eau Claire. Diana, hi.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, my goodness. I was just calling to comment on Jon Stewart's show and how much I will miss him when he's gone.
And are you going to keep watching with the new host?
Pardon?
Are you going to keep watching with the new host?
I don't know who the new host is.
Trevor Noah.
Trevor Noah is his name, yeah.
Is his name. They're going to redo the set. They're going to do some new things with it. And Diana, the clearly a big fan of Jon Stewart there.
And Diana raises a question, I think, Robert Thompson. Can Jon Stewart be replaced in a significant way for his fans?
Well, he's been doing this 16 years. I think this is a good time for him to go. And I think there's a certain noble idea that he's going at the best time for comedy people. As the 2016 election gears up, let's remember, Jon Stewart really got to hit his stride because he was starting near an election season. And now he's letting Trevor Noah take off, who should be able to hit the ground running because he's going to have all of this material. The caller said she's going to miss Jon Stewart. I'm going to miss him already tonight, even when he's still on, because as we're speaking, the first GOP debate is winding down. And all I keep thinking of, oh, what's Jon Stewart going to say about this? And, of course, he's not going to say anything because they've already taped, or they're taping now the show tonight, and we won't see his comments on any of these things.
He's stepping down, but I assume he's not going away. What do you expect him to do now that he's not in that Daily Show chair?
Well, I think part of it was he really did need to get out of the grind. I take him seriously that his kids were growing up and he wanted to be a part of their life. I think he enjoyed making that movie. He could make another one of those. Some have suggested 5 weeks from now, when he gets bored of retirement, he may even start to think about some kind of public office. I don't think he'll go away the way Johnny Carson did when he retired, and the way I think Letterman will continue to do now that he's retired.
I think he's younger, for one thing.
Right. He's a lot younger, and I can't imagine him just being the New Jersey farmer he keeps saying he's going to become.
As we wrap up, Robert, with or without Jon Stewart, is investigative comedy here to stay as a genre?
Yes, and I think it's a good thing for us as citizens of a democratic republic. Two people that trained under Stewart in The Daily Show, as I mentioned before, John Oliver and Larry Wilmore, are doing, I think, some extraordinary stuff on television. And who knows, Trevor Noah, who's got a totally different voice than Jon Stewart. He's a really smart guy. He's going to have a totally different point of view. He could be as exciting in 2015 when he starts as Jon Stewart was in 1999 or 2000 when he hit his stride.
Well, have fun watching tonight, Robert.
I will. You too.
Robert Thompson's a professor of television and pop culture at Syracuse University. He was with us to look back at Jon Stewart's 16 years as host of The Daily Show.